After learning how to cultivate grain some 10,000 years ago, we learned how to bake it and brew it. Thus began our history as a fermenting people. This history leads us to ask, how did fermentation help we the people survive and prosper?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,328th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, 10,000 years after brewing up our first batch of beer, we are only now coming to realize how thoroughly those little bubble-making bacteria have infused themselves into our lives. In fact, we can now look at ourselves in the mirror and say good morning to the trillions of microorganisms that we now know live in and on our body. And we all now know as well that each and every one of us is a walking, talking Amazon jungle of life. Was it always such, even back there 10 millenniums ago? Or did we build this relationship up over time? If we think about it, our most enduring relationship with bacteria has been through the deliberate fermentation of our food and drink. The encouragement and management of those tiny little critters is how we make bread, cheese, yogurt, vinegar, sauerkraut, soy sauce, and oh yes, beer and wine. All of the fermented foods and drinks we consume, and all of the trillions of microbes that live in and on us, lead us to ask, how did fermentation help us survive and prosper? Who better to ask than Dr. Julia Skinner, who is the author of Our Fermented Lives and the founder of Root, a fermentation company. Dr. Julia, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
Now, I certainly know what Our Fermented Lives is because I have one in my hand here, but what is Root?
So Root is a fermentation and food history company. So just like with Our Fermented Lives, basically through classes and through events and through a newsletter and all these other things, I try to help people find the ways that they connect to the history of food and the ways to make that personal to them today.
Well, I hope we can help you do just that today. And toward that end, I would like to start this conversation with kind of how you started Our Fermented Lives, and that is by bringing up friendship bread. What is friendship bread?
So friendship bread, I thought, was a really good way to introduce the book because, you know, we all think about, like, what's the first fermented food that I made? And the first one I made as an adult, the first one I knew was fermented, was sauerkraut. But I had been making friendship bread with my mom when I was a kid, which is basically, if you've never made friendship bread before, it's basically this runny fermented batter that people pour into Ziploc bags and they'll divide them out and give them to friends, and then the friends will make them and give them to other friends. And it's kind of, you know, it's like an email chain letter, but bread starter.
So
and it's sour and
yeah,
it's
so
delicious.
It's a starter.
Mm-hmm.
What's in the starter?
Well, so it is flour and water, as you might expect, and then I think there's some milk and some sugar in there too. When you bake it off, you then add, you know, eggs and a bunch of other stuff. But mm-hmm. when you're just making the starter itself, just milk and flour mostly.
Now, is this something, when we were college students, my wife and I ate a lot of sourdough bread, and we kept the starter mm-hmm. going for years and years and years. Is the starter for friendship bread similar to that, wherein it contains a culture?
Yeah. Yeah, so it is just a different kind of sourdough. Mm-hmm. So, the sourdough that you make on your counter with just flour and water, you know, is one way of making a sourdough starter culture. And then this is just one of the other ways. I mean, the injera recipe that I have in here, too, is also, you know, a wild cultured bread of its own sort.
So when you hand out these starters to your friends, what you're doing is handing them a starter, a culture.
Yeah,
In doing that, you're starting a community of sorts, are you not?
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, what I love about doing this this research for this book, and what I love about fermentation is that we see all of these ways that fermentation supports our human communities. I think that's a great example, right, of just the physical giving of, you know, the gift of something to ferment with, of a food. That's a great gift. And there's so many other ways, too. You know, something I've been thinking about a lot lately is that when we ferment food in communities, you know, I talk in the book a lot about, you know, and it's harvest season, which is kind of why this is coming to my mind, I think. When we talk about, you know, harvest festivals and kind of how historically people would come together and put up food for the winter and make all these ferments, you know, the fermentation is supporting the community in a couple different ways. One of them being that it's bringing everybody together in the first place to make this food. But then you're making that as an act of community care and food security for the future. So you're providing care and community building in a couple different ways there.
And building bridges from person to person. Now, of course, we wonder what the heck is fermentation. And I think Sandor Katz had a very good explanation. Would you like to tell us about that?
Yes, so Sandor's definition is the one that I find best encompasses this, and it's the transformative action of microbes. And I like that definition a lot because I think it really captures the breadth of what all of this is. I mean, because if you think about fermented food, we're talking about everything from that bread, of course, but to sauerkraut, to beer, to wine, to cheese, to, you know, soy sauce, miso, vanilla, coffee, like just such a range of foods that we eat that I think thinking about the transformation rather than talking about one specific process really helps us understand just how big this is and how important it is in our lives.
And when we're passing our starter from one person to the next to make our friendship bread, does not each one of us that works with this culture somehow leave a little imprint on it of ourselves?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one thing that I really enjoy about working with wild fermentation and with, you know, starters is, you know, that when I bring a sourdough starter into my home and I work with it for a while, it's going to take on kind of that fingerprint of my space. You know, it may not taste all that different, but it might taste a bit different. I mean, a famous example would be San Francisco sourdough. You know, that tastes very different than what I make in my house in Atlanta. And those, you know, that's because of the different microbes that are in these different places.
And the microbes become part of you because you're working with them. They're kind of like a herd of cows in a very weird sense. I mean, they're not quite that big.
Yeah.
But, you know, they are a herd. They're a community. They're a colony.
Yeah.
So the next question I have to ask is, do you think fermentation played a role in developing the populations of microorganisms that now inhabit and colonize us?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, when we look at history, when we look at how our bodies evolved and developed, we were evolving alongside these microorganisms since before we were human. I mean, we've had a microbiome for a very, very long time. We've evolved, you know, like from microorganisms ourselves, and then eventually became the hosts of microorganisms that did nice things for us in return. And then we started eating foods that had these microorganisms on them. It kind of, you know, so it kind of turned into this beautiful relationship. But yeah, I mean, I think the fact that we eat so much fermentation or so much fermented food, the fact that fermentation is such an important part of our history, I mean, does have some physiological roots.
And then how did you become such a holy warrior for fermenting foods? What was it? Do you remember the day the apple fell on your head and you?
It's funny because I kind of came to it in stages, and I think, you know, fermentation is beautiful because it's not instant gratification. That transformation of microbes takes time, and it runs counter to our very, you know, instant gratification, everything ready to go kind of culture.
Oh, and you made mention of you made mention, I think it was Sandor Katz that said something about fermentation is a way of slowing down food.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's, you know, Sandor Katz describes it as the ultimate slow food, and I think it's appropriate then that my relationship with fermentation kind of had that slow trajectory as well, that it took its time to really transform into what it is today. You know, I started making sauerkraut and then yogurt when I had a bunch of cabbages. It's kind of, you know, many of us, I think, start fermenting food in this way. We're like, well, I've got a bunch of stuff I need to preserve. Sauerkraut it is. And then so I kind of started to go down the rabbit hole that way. And then, you know, then I started learning about other things and making fermented hot sauces and, you know, miso paste and whatever else. And, you know, just kind of went down this whole fermentation rabbit hole, and it became more and more important to me as a person. I met more and more people who it was important to, and I just realized, you know, what a pivotal part of our lives this is, and what a special experience to make these foods in a time where we're so often asked to not have these, you know, this sort of an experience with our food, where we're not asked to slow down, and where we maybe don't have the opportunity to have like a really nice living food. So it's become a very fun experience to help myself slow down. Like, it's become kind of like a spiritual, mindful thing as well as an actual cooking thing.
It's almost antithetical to fast food world. You can't do it mm-hmm. fast. You have to do it slow. Mm-mm. And when you do it slow, you can take the time to see what you're doing and actually learn to enjoy what you're doing instead of shoveling that stuff into your face and gobbling it down. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Dr. Julia Skinner, author of Our Fermented Lives. Yes, we are fermenters. Get used to it. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, you know, it's been with us a long time, a great tool. In effect, we've become herders of those tiny little bacteria that we can't even see. And we use them to build foods for us that help us survive and prosper. And we've been doing it a long time. Dr. Julia Skinner, what, 15,000 years for mead, I think, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We don't have exact dates, but it has been many, 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 many years, at least 10,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is mead but honey, correct?
So, yeah, it's just honey and water. And honey, you know, honey is very cool because it already has all of the sugars and the yeasts and everything you need to make mead already in it. You don't have to add anything. I mean, you certainly can, but you can just put honey in water and stir it up and, you know, keep checking it and stirring it, and you'll get mead.
And that's pretty simple. And so even those folks 15,000 years ago who did not have any thermometers or glass beakers or casks, they figured out how to make mead. And have you ever, I'm sure you have, but what do you think their experience was like when they had their first sip of mead?
I mean, I imagine, you know, as I talk about in the book, there's a story of the Khoisan people who are in what is modern-day South Africa. And there's this story that they came upon this beehive after a rainstorm. It was a beehive in a tree. And, you know, surely knew what honey was by that point. And saw that this beehive that had the honey that they knew they liked was then bubbling. And I mean, think about if you've never seen this like bubbling honey mixture before, that would seem like a pretty magical moment. And some brave soul came up and said, like, I'm going to try it. I'm going to see what happens here.
And then he started dancing around the fire and singing and having the time of his life.
Well, just the experience of the flavor itself, I mean, tastes like honey, but it's different. I mean, it would have been probably a very special thing, I would think.
I would think so, too. I always wondered how they contained it, though, 15,000 years ago, because I think that was even before we started working with ceramics and whatnot. So maybe just put it in a stone bowl of some kind, I guess. Way back when.
Well, you could do that. Wooden vessels. I mean, you know, people are pretty ingenious about turning things into containers. So, I'm sure that we had, whatever kind of hollowed out kind of stump or, carved wood or whatever. You know, the problem with kind of knowing the full history of this is that some of those early vessels would have been biodegradable. So.
Right.
You know, we may never know kind of what the earliest vessels were.
Now, what we do know are that there are definite benefits to alcohol in the form of fermented mead, for example, because it provided them with a relatively safe thing to drink. Kind of protected them and intoxicated them. So, given all of the benefits, you know, they probably became pretty ingenious about how to make more mead, I guess.
Yeah. Well, if we look at the history of, you know, water safety around the world, I mean, you've brought up a good point here, is that we do have a lot of records of people making beer and wine and things. And these alcohols, kind of the daily drinking ones, wouldn't have been very strong. You know, it's not like me pouring a glass of, you know, the wine that's, you know, sitting on my counter right now. It would have been a lot weaker than that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a way, by fermenting it and making a very low alcohol beverage, it was a way to crowd out the potentially harmful microbes in that beverage so that you could hydrate yourself if you didn't know the potability of your water source.
Which was very important in a lot of circumstances throughout the world. Give me something safe to drink. And it's like that today when it gets right down to it. Moving on in history to Jiahu, China, 10,000 years ago or so, we have an actual record because we were able to carbon date some products inside of a vessel. And we found that they were putting together all kinds of things in fermenting them. It was rice, and they were huckleberry, I think it was, and something else. So they were, you know, getting pretty sophisticated in how they're doing this.
Yeah, you know, I really like the, you know, the Jiahu story, because, you know, what you see there is you don't just see, you know, I think we assume that our ancestors were like, you know, okay, well, it's time to make rice wine, it's just rice, you know, or it's time to make, you know, whatever other wine, and it's just the, you know, whatever fruit I'm using. But, you know, we, of course, our ancestors had taste buds, too. They wanted to have things that tasted good, and they were also creative. And I think that's a great historical example of that in action. I mean, you see there's, like, this fruit, and there's, you know, the rice, and there's all of these. There's, what, like, five or six different ingredients in there.
The whole
and
banquet table, almost.
Those together. Yeah. Somebody's blending those together to make this delicious drink.
And then it becomes even more precious. So that was 10,000 years ago. They found, you know, something in a, I think it was buried deep in a kind of an anaerobic situation where nothing decomposed. And there it was. You know, I think it was 9,000 years ago when I first read that story. But a long time ago. And there we are.
Yeah.
We've already figured out how to ferment things, make wine, preserve the food, make safe drinking water, and have a lot of fun, just like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's move up to the Fertile Crescent, which is where we actually can point to the fact that this is where we began cultivating grains. And once we get grains, what the heck do we do with them? Well, we can make bread or we can make beer. So which came first?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because the truth is that they both probably developed around the same time. You know, the driver for both bread and beer would have been agriculture. You know, when we were, you know, pre-agricultural and moving around more, maybe weren't in permanent settlements, it would have been hard to take, you know, certainly we knew how to eat wild grains. I mean, people wouldn't have gone to all the effort to domesticate them if they didn't have value, right? So we already knew what grains were, but if you're moving around a bunch, kind of keeping starter cultures going and certainly carrying things with beer would have been hard. So when we finally are settled down in communities and we have, you know, we're domesticating these grains and we're kind of experimenting with them and grinding them and, you know, doing all the things we do with them, you know, it's, and who knows exactly what the catalyst was that brought these two things about. You know, for example, was it that somebody maybe, you know, started mixing a flour paste together to make something else and then got distracted and came back and it was bubbling and they were like, all right, let's go with it. Or, you know, maybe somebody left some grains out and it rained and then that started fermenting and they were like, oh, that, you know, okay, that's a thing. You know, it could have started a lot of different ways.
Because the bacteria are always there. They're wild. They populate just about everything. Mm-hmm. And if you give them the right conditions, away they go.
Yeah, so the wild yeasts on those grains, I mean, yeah, I make beer and bread with wild yeast all the time. And it's, you know, it's wonderful, and it's very much how people have done it for 10,000 or so years.
Yeah, and 6,000 years ago, Sumerians were using beer as barter, as money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we go into Egypt. And, well, that's how they built the pyramids, right?
Yeah, yeah. You both pay people in it, and it's, you know, I mean, if you think about it, beer has, you know, it's obviously a beverage, but it also has, you know, B vitamins, and it has other stuff in it, too, carbohydrates. So, like, it does actually give your body some nutrients, too. And that's, you know, that's, I think, also an interesting part of that history.
Mm-hmm. And then wine is just beer made with grapes. Is that fair to say?
I mean, a bit of a different process. So with wine, you know, and it's, I think it's interesting because the nomenclature that we use for both is messy, because language is messy. But you know, beer, we tend to think of grains that are cooked down and you add in your starter, however that looks. And then you then take that and ferment it. With your wine, you know, when we think of wine, it's whatever fruit juice, you know, grape juice being, you know, the most famous, but there's, you know, peach wine and plenty of other kinds of wines. But then we get into things like rice wine. Well, that's brewed more like beer, but it's called rice wine because it's, you know, eventually made to be at a higher alcohol content, because it has a higher starch content and so can ferment more. Mead, we call honey wine. Well, that's just honey and water. Is it wine? Is it beer? It's kind of its own thing. Like, it can get a little messy.
So everything, though, is the beneficiary of having been worked over, transformed, as it were, as Mr. Katz would say, by the bacteria, and transformed into something new and different and exciting for everybody concerned. You may mention of the home breweries, wherein, you know, most food was local at that time, so a lot of people made their own beer, which was kind of a kitchen responsibility, I think you made mention of.
Yeah, so the history of beer in Europe is really interesting because, you know, now when we think about the craft beer industry, it's a very, very male-dominated industry. But for a lot of history, beer was made by women, and it was made either in the home, or you would have kind of a local woman in your community who would make and sell it. And this was kind of how this went for a long time, and it was an avenue for women both to nourish their families, but it was also one of the few ways that women could actually participate in business, to have a business, was to brew beer. And so we start to see this shift in the early modern period. I think in the 1600s, 1700s, there's suddenly an interest by men in brewing beer on kind of a more commercial scale and having it be regulated by guilds, which women can't join or couldn't join at the time. And so it moves out of this home and like cottage industry space into kind of a more commercial space. And as that happens, the people who were kind of the traditional stewards of these processes and knowledge were then blocked from being able to make a living at it. Home brewing was still rather common even during that.
Yeah. It sounds like what we see happening with the cannabis industry right now, wherein all of the home growers are being put out of business by virtue of legal sanctions and the industrialization of the processes. Interesting observation. At any rate, take us to dairy products, because dairy was also fermented or treated to the transformation as well, was it not?
Yeah. So, you know, our early history of, you know, yogurt is a great place to start. And, you know, we all, I'm sure many of us have our favorite yogurts, and I'm sure that many of your listeners probably make their own. But that, you know, yogurt, we're almost positive that that was found kind of accidentally. Somebody had brought milk with them as a beverage on a journey and brought it in a flask that was made out of animal hide. And, you know, the milk got inoculated with these bacteria, these lactic acid bacteria, and they're, you know, out riding their horse to their destination, and it's, you know, warm out and sunny and stuff, and it kind of incubates it, and they get there, and they're like, well, what is this? But I need this food, so I'm going to go with it. And we have yogurt now. Yeah. You know, we have, then people started to discover, like, oh, this is good. We actually want this.
And, of course, yogurt or curdled milk was what powered the Mongol hordes of Genghis Khan. They put their mare's milk in a leather bag, and put it under their saddle and race off across the steppes, you know, conquering everything in sight. And then they'd pause in the evening and they'd have yogurt to eat. The horses would have grasses to eat. So everything they needed was right there, a very precious commodity. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program, the 1328th edition of the Food Chain. Today we're talking about our fermented lives and the part fermentation plays in the, our development as a we the people, how it's helped us get by in tough times, how it's provided food for us along the way, and how it provided a way for us to preserve food for in times of plenty, for when there were times of scarcity. So a great friend, those tiny little bacteria that we've never seen before, but now we know they're there in the trillions for all of us. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, there is so much to say because it's such a huge, huge topic. Fermentation. Been a big part of human culinary skills for what, 15,000 years before we even knew what we were. We were fermenting things. And even today, when we can look in the mirror and say good morning to the trillions of microorganisms that live in and on us, we're just amazed at that. To what extent these tiny little bacteria have infused themselves into our lives. Truly amazing. And we're blessed to have this relationship with bugs. And when do you think we started realizing that, wow, we're just part of an Amazon jungle of living creatures?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because I think for a long time we've considered ourselves as part of our ecosystem. You know, us being separate from our ecosystem, you know, is a much more recent way of being. But we didn't really start to learn about the microbiome itself. We had a sense that something was going on, but we didn't have, you know, microscopes and all of that until, what, a couple hundred years ago? And then we started to really see, oh, there's actually actual things there, living things. You know, and it was interesting because when we started discovering these microbes and classifying them and things, you know, what we started with was pathogenic microbes. And I think perhaps because of that and, you know, the very real health concerns that those posed, we kind of went towards a, like, all microbes are bad perspective. And now that we're learning more about our microbiome and, like, no, we actually need these, we kind of realized, like, that pendulum swung a bit far. Like, we kind of went a little too in the, like, sterilize, sanitize everything direction. And, like, cleanliness is obviously important. Like, hygiene is good. But, you know, we do also need to eat probiotic food, and we do also need to, you know, have our microbiome be functional. So it's, I think our understanding of it has evolved a lot, but I think now we're really starting to get this understanding of, like what you said, of us being an Amazon forest of all of these creatures.
And yet, even way back in the beginning, we the people had the sense that our digestion was in fact a fermentive process of some kind, not knowing, of course, what kind or anything, but it was just something we suspected.
Yeah, well, you know, digestion has always really captured the curiosity of people, and, you know, the ways that we've described it, you know, and I talk about this a bit in the book about, we've described it as anything from, like, stones that grind in the belly and it's an actual physical grinding action to, like, a bubbling action or, like, a heating and cooking action. Like, there's a lot of different ways that we've thought about it, but a lot of them do have overlap with fermentation, like bubbling, for example, heating. So kind of an interesting, like, yes, like, we, even though we didn't have maybe the language to describe it in the way we would today, you know, I think our ancestors, like, were trying to get there as best they could, like, but using the, you know, using the tools they had.
And now as we look at it, we're coming to realize that we can actually feed those critters that are, that inhabit our digestive tract. We can actually, you know, feed them as if they were the family pet or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like, in the book, I have an anecdote from Ken Albala where he talks about his starters on his shelf being like, you know, little herds of, you know, sheep and cattle and stuff that he's, you know, tending to. And I like, you know, I like that kind of like stewardship idea. But then I also like the fact that a lot of our traditional fermented foods, like, for example, sauerkraut, I mean, they feed us in a couple different ways, one of them being that they're both prebiotic and probiotic. So they have the dietary fiber we need, while also having those living cultures to help keep us healthy. You know, and then we also have, you know, all the other benefits, the B vitamins and the just all, you know, the nutrients from the vegetables themselves. I mean, there's so much goodness in there.
And just cabbage to start with, sauerkraut to end with. Would you be so kind as to lead us through a ferment of cabbage?
Absolutely. So fermenting cabbage is very easy, and there's a couple ways one can make sauerkraut. I tend to recommend the more traditional way, which is basically where you salt your cabbage and then you massage that salt into the cabbage. That breaks down the cell walls and actually releases the liquid from the cabbage itself, so you don't need to add any water. If you have, say, arthritis or something that would make that uncomfortable, you can absolutely stir that salt in water and pour it over your shredded cabbage. But it is very rewarding to actually get your hands in there if you're able to. And so then you just pack that salted cabbage and, you know, the liquid it's releasing into jars, you know, pack it down or a crock, whatever food-safe container. Pack it in there, try to kind of get, you know, press the air out of it and stuff. And then that brine will continue to come out of that cabbage, and you just want to make sure that it's completely over the top of your cabbage. You don't want to have the cabbage exposed to the air because that can make it mold. But if it's under the brine, it won't mold because mold is aerobic and needs oxygen. The lactic acid bacteria don't need oxygen, so they will function just fine. So then after that, you know, in my recipe, which is based on making it in jars, I'll fold a cabbage leaf over and put it on top to kind of hold everything down. And so you can do that. You can, you know, whatever. You can put a weight on it. There's a lot of different ways to kind of hold that cabbage in place. But then you just put the lid on, check it every day. When it tastes like sauerkraut, like when it has the flavor you want, congratulations, you made sauerkraut. You can put it in the fridge.
In that process, it's very simple. Yeah, in that process, we can add spices, right?
Mm-hmm. You can add spices. You can add other vegetables. I really like, so when I think about ways I can reduce food waste in my kitchen, for example, making a batch of sauerkraut and then being like, okay, I've got, say, these carrot peels and, like, these little bits of beets or something. You know, I can grate that up or chop it up or whatever and throw it in there. And then, you know, that's something that's not going in the compost that's coming back to nourish me and reducing my footprint a bit. But, yeah, you can add, I mean, the sky's the limit for the flavors and other things you can add in there.
So have fun.
Yes, absolutely.
Just have fun. Now, would you be so kind as to tell us the story of ketchup?
Yes. So ketchup has a very interesting history, which I learned about while researching our fermented lives. And it comes actually from England, where in China, they brought fish sauce over to England and trade between the two countries. So the English try this fish sauce and they're like, wow, that's sure good. Would love more of that. And so start to kind of try to make their own with other ingredients. And so the earliest versions of ketchup actually didn't have any tomatoes in them. I mean, we also have to remember that tomatoes themselves
were thought to be poison, right?
Central South America. Well, they were thought to be poison for... Tomatoes have a really interesting history. I mean, people, because they're in the nightshade family, there was like this concept that they were poisonous. But they also were not indigenous to Europe. So they weren't even in Europe until like the 15 or 1600s. And so prior to that, you know, I mean, around that same time is when we started making our mushroom ketchups and all of these other ketchups. There's dozens of different kinds. I mean, walnut and mushroom are kind of the two that stick first in my mind, but there were plenty of others. And basically you would ferment and add, you know, add vinegar and stuff to make these kind of like umami-rich sour sauces that you could then use, you know, as a garnish. And then people would often take the pickled mushrooms, walnuts, whatever, out of it and use that as well as a condiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead with your history
of ketchup.
Eventually,
eventually somebody realized that tomatoes would work well in this because they have they have a lot of umami, right? And so they started to be used. And then eventually kind of came to supplant the other things as people began to introduce tomato ketchup as like a commercial product. Suddenly the mushroom ketchup and all the other ones, you know, not that they don't exist anymore, but, you know, they're kind of not as popular, kind of hard to find. And so, yeah, ketchup became just this one thing where it has this whole really rich history we often don't know about.
And I'm curious as to what made it so popular. I suspect it's the amount of sugar they put in it. Am I wrong?
Well, so the early ketchups didn't have a lot of sugar in them. I think now that's probably true. I mean, modern ketchup, if you try the mushroom ketchup recipe in the book versus a bottle of store-bought ketchup, those are going to taste very different, and not just because of the different base ingredients, but just the sweetness of it. Ketchup historically has been much more savory, vinegary, salty, and it's kind of gotten sweeter over time. And, you know, is the sugariness of it maybe part of why it's popular now? Possibly. We certainly like sweet things.
Yeah, we do. Does the sweetness kind of detract from the umami?
I mean, I think that in our modern store-bought ketchup, I would say it does. You know, I think the two can balance each other really well, but I think, you know, we often don't let ourselves have those really nicely balanced condiments. I mean, a good homemade ketchup where you can taste all the ingredients and you can taste the spices and the umami and that bit of vinegar and the sugar is just kind of there to round it out. Very different experience.
I have a whole bunch of ripe tomatoes, and I know what I'm going to do with them. I'm going to go make some homemade ketchup. Well, how do I do that?
Well, so it's very easy. I mean, you can make it with tomato paste. You can also grind down your own tomatoes. I actually have a recipe for it in the book here.
Ooh.
And you know, what I typically do is I will ferment the tomatoes for a couple days, and depending on what kind of tomatoes you're working with, you know, if they're paste tomatoes with lower water content, you know, maybe you won't need to cook them down after that. But if they're, you know, if they're really watery, right. you may have to. But, yeah, you basically will ferment the tomatoes to get a little bit of that sourness. You can always add vinegar, too. You can always just use, you know, tomato paste. I mean, it's whatever's easiest for you. And then you add your vinegar and your spices, and you just kind of mix it all up and, you know, you have a very nice homemade ketchup. I also like to add a little bit of brown sugar, not a ton, but like, you know, just to round it out.
Little bit, little touch. Now, What do you, Dr. Julia Skinner, make, ferment, that has your neighbors hanging around the back door?
I make a lot of sauerkraut, and I often will share that with friends. People are also big fans of when I make mead and tapache. The tapache is one of the ones people especially like.
Now, what is tapache?
And that's one of the recipes. So tapache is just a fermented pineapple beverage. It can be alcoholic or not. You know, I tend to make it not very alcoholic, but it's very, very refreshing and very, very good. So that's one of the recipes that's inside of the book.
We should make mention of that book. And I have one here in my hands. It's Our Fermented Lives, a history. It's not only a history, but it is also a recipe book. So it's just everything you need to know about fermented foods, how to ferment them, the history of fermentation, and how all of that goes to make our lives much better. Thank you to those little bugs. Mm-hmm. And thank you to Dr. Julia Skinner for joining us on The Food Chain today. Much appreciated, Julie.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Thank you so much. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain: the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.